Greetings, salutations from the Agile Podcast. Tony here.
I'm Tyson here.
Renee.
And Craig.
And I'm David Marquet. I'm visiting.
Well, yeah, we are blessed with David Marquet today. And, of course, we have Tyson Nutt with us as well, who's a bit of a nut for David Marquet. Sorry, I couldn't go past the pun.
It's all right. You can be excused.
And we're at Agile Australia. So we're just talking to David after his fantastic keynote speech.
Awesome job.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Questions? Well, I thought seeing as Tyson, you're the man in the hot seat there, you'd have a couple of questions.
I've got a few. So
far away, my friend.
A rip.
I came across your book probably about 12 months or so ago, and I thought, wow, there's so many great correlations here between lots of the stuff that we talk about within Agile teams and in the organisations that we coach. I'm curious to find out when you came across this Agile thing and how your understanding of how those two worlds kind of met.
Yeah, so
Surely you had post-it notes on the inside of it.
I love post-it notes and cards and, you know, those kind of things. First of all, I think Agile is really, really powerful because Agile is about giving control down to the people who have the information, and it's just sort of by luck. That's basically what my leadership approach was. But what happened was my book came out, and my mom bought 10 copies, and then a few other people started buying it, and I got this long Facebook post message from a guy named Ole Jepsen, who works in Agile over in Copenhagen. And he was very enthusiastic and said, oh, this is just like Agile. Of course, I didn't know, like, Agile to me was like the way a cheetah runs, right?
Yeah.
And so I started reading about it. I said, well, man, this stuff is really awesome. And so then I kind of got sucked in. I went over to Copenhagen and talked to some people, and like one thing led to another. And now I'm here in Australia for the very first time, which is super awesome for me. Super pumped about that.
So I'm feeling really compelled to tell the listeners who may not actually know anything about your
book. What the heck is this
story? Turn the ship around. It's about your journey on a submarine vessel, the Santa Fe, which you were on in 1999. Mm. And it's really like the journey of going from one leader on that ship to over a couple hundred leaders.
Yeah.
And how you went about that.
Yeah, and the book, I tried to be really vulnerable about up I was as a leader, because I thought leadership was about telling people what to do and getting them to do it. And on the submarine, you know, it's a long story short, but basically I gave an order that couldn't be done, and my guys tried to do it anyway, and I realized this is messed up. And so the only way out of it was for me to stop giving orders. So try and imagine a company or a ship where the person at the top is not telling people what to do. And at first it was there was a lot of chaos and, well, not chaos, but, you know, there was confusion. But finally what happened is we released the passion and energy of everybody on the team, which was awesome.
Transformed a vessel that was the worst.
It was terrible.
0% retention on the officer level.
Yeah, yeah. It was, when I got there, it was the depressing, demoralizing, terrible place to be. Basically, everyone was getting out of the Navy. No one wanted to be there. The ship was performing badly. And, yeah, we turned it all around. But I really like to say the story is about what happened over the next 10 years, where officer after officer after officer, chief after chief after chief, went on to these other jobs and did more and more and more. And that's kind of a long-term thing. All investments in human beings are long-term.
Well, which sort of brings it back to like an agile transformation is that you start sometimes with one person and it spreads from there.
Yeah.
You talked today around the fact that 10 of your officers are now commanding ships themselves.
Yeah.
Did they end up using the same sort of philosophy, approach, techniques as you did? Or?
Yeah, in their own way. I mean, they all adapted it a little bit. A lot of the basics of what we did, for example, we talked about don't brief, certify.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about saying I intend to rather than asking for permission. Some of the other things we talked about were the leader thinking out loud and being vulnerable about exposing what they're thinking and their fears and their concerns. So to a large degree, they took those things, and it's kind of spreading like this cancer throughout the Navy because they keep promoting these guys. Yeah.
But that was the interesting thing for me. So you're spreading it through the people.
Yeah.
What about the Navy themselves? Are they taking it on? Because once it starts, like, it's a virus, right? So Agile's the same thing. We've seen it when you do transformation.
Right.
it spreads, and it's very hard to contain it. So what are they doing about that now?
Well, they put the book, Turn the Ship Around, on the official Navy reading list.
Wow.
Which was really good. Yeah. Two navies have done that so far. The Kiwis... And the Americans.
We don't want to hear about that.
I'm just saying.
To be fair, the Kiwis have one ship.
So. Yeah, oh, man.
Didn't it break in half and sink?
No. We welcome the Kiwis this morning.
So, David, when you're in that position where you knew that your leadership training that you'd had wasn't going to work in the environment that you were in, you know, you knew that something was going to have to change, you were going to have to do something differently.
No.
And you knew that it was going to be an experiment, and it might fail. I know in your book that you had the your leader above you was aware that this was an experiment and that it might actually fail. Yeah. But was everyone aware that this thing was an experiment, and that was it sort of seen as an open cultural experiment, or was it still something that you were kind of trying to hide in some way? Or?
No. We were very open about what we were doing. A lot of people. I mean, we would tell them. You know, I'm not giving orders. And then they would just think, oh, you're just giving really good orders. I mean, we would tell them what we were doing, but their mindsets of what leadership was about were so rigid. They just didn't understand what we were doing. And we had a really important moment with the crew where after this cock-up on the order that I gave, I said, look, here's what I think. And initially I was like, well, you guys got to step up. It was all about you guys. And then finally I realized it's really about me. And the thing that I can do is to stop telling them what to do and then create the space for them to step forward. And I asked them, I said, hey, do we want to do this? Do we want to go down this path? And there was a lot of head nodding. And it was sort of this automatic head nodding. And then I said, so... Okay, but I want to make sure we all understand what this means. Yeah, you really understand what this means. And even I didn't really understand what it meant and all the ramifications. But the important thing was there was a commitment by the team to do it. And I think if they had said, no, we don't want to do it, I was pretty sure they weren't because it was just a dismal place to be. But if they'd said that, I would have been okay. I would have said, okay, fine. And I would have waited 3 months and tried it again. Yeah.
So one of the little throwaway lines I heard you say in the speech, right? So you basically said you moved to the I intend to.
Yeah.
And you talked a lot about that, but there was a little bit there that said, even though you said I intend to, that doesn't mean they got to do it.
Right.
Right.
Right,
so,
right.
So
right,
I think the important thing there is that we need to talk about that because otherwise people are going to hear the I intend to and go, oh, we're just going to do the I intend to and it's a free for all.
Right. So that's really good, Tony, because people hear that's good, that's easy, right? I intend to, blah, blah, blah. But they don't have... That's just saying hello on the phone, right? And then we have a conversation. And the purpose of I intend to is, one, to give you psychological ownership because you're coming to me saying I intend to do X, Y, Z. But the second thing is the purpose is to spark the conversation so that
transparency of what's going
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Yeah. So I say, well, why are you doing that? You know, why do you want to do that? And it's in those conversations that I get to learn how my team thinks about leadership and about what our mission and purpose is. And sometimes that was scary. but that's when I knew, okay, so for Tony, when you come to me and say, I intend to submerge a ship, after a week or two, I would just say, very well, because you got it. We don't need to go through the whole rigmarole anymore. But for somebody else, new person, I might have to, you know, we'd start over and say, okay, explain it to me. But that's a really important point. It's not enough to just say, I intend to, and just parrot the things like,
It becomes by rote then, otherwise. It's just another process
exactly.
of layer
right,
of judgment.
Right, right, right. It's just a checklist. Yeah. Check, done, crash.
And I think in your second book, you give a really good example of that thinking out aloud where you talk about you're teaching your daughter to drive.
Yeah.
Brave man.
And you were knife's edge every single time you hopped into the car until she started thinking out loud so that you were aware of that she had visibility of those risks.
Yeah, so thinking out loud is the idea that we just say what's going on in our heads. And so many times we're like trapped inside our heads. We got all this stuff going on, and we don't say it. So it happened on the submarine, and then I realized that the same thing was happening with my daughter in the car. And I'll just skip to that because all the listeners, I think, will get it. So I'm driving along. I'm in the passenger seat. She's driving. She's a brand-new driver. and I'm like holding tightly under the, you know, under the seat, because I don't know, you know, I see a family playing near the road. I'm wondering, does she see them? Is she ready to slow down? Does she see the car that's coming? And it's just quiet. The car's just quiet. And so we said, hey, Emily, just kind of tell me what's going on. Like, what do you see? So she would say, I see the family. I see the car. I'm ready to slow down if I need to. I see the lights turning red. And we don't, you know, train or coach people to do that. It feels kind of weird. Mm. Like, why do I need to do that? You don't need it. But once you do it, it allows me to give control. Because before that, I was like, oh, so, you know, I'm reaching over to grab the wheel, which is crappy. So for teams, and you got a controlling boss who's demanding information. We call it feed the beast, right? Don't respond by like hiding. Just keep shoveling information at them and inundate them with information. And because giving them information is a mechanism for control, for you to be in control of your own.
And that's a great way to turn the relationship around, about this not necessarily being a process that a leader does, but this is how you can sort of emancipate yourself.
Right, right.
So talk a little bit about the difference in your mind between empowerment versus emancipation.
Yeah, so I love to hate the word empowerment, because my problem is this, I think the word's kind of polluted and it's overused, and like thou shalt be empowered, and it was corrupted. And I would be the guy who said, well, oh, that's wonderful, thank you, sir. What was I before that? Oh, where you were, I guess, unempowered. And it's like, so it took you to give me power. Yeah. Like, well, it doesn't seem very powerful. It sucks. And so and it just feels wrong. Like, I don't think we give people power. People have power by being human. Like, you know, anyone who has kids past the age of 2 knows kids they aren't asking permission, right? And so what we do, you can't empower people. All you can do is unempower them.
Mm.
So I try to use a different word, and that's the idea of emancipation, is just get out of their way. You know, create clarity of purpose, make sure they have the technical competence to do their job, the tools and resources to do their job, and then get the F out of their way.
Sort of sounds like Dan Pink's drive, master, autonomy, purpose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Pink's got mastery, autonomy, purpose. I have control, competence, clarity. I'm not saying Pink stole my stuff, you know. No, but it just sort of happened.
Are you listening there, Dan?
Yeah, 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 right. But it just kind of happened at the same time. Mine was a practical example. I just sort of came up with those. And his was based on research that people did. And it kind of makes sense. So I said, if you don't believe me, look at Dan Pink, right?
So, David, 15 years on, we know that this approach was successful, yeah, and it transformed the Santa Fe, and it's had ripples throughout the Navy and other organizations. But were there times during that change where you weren't sure if it was going to succeed?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had doubt, self-doubt, fear.
Was it close to failing? Were you
going to jump ship to go back?
We had early on, the mistake that I made. Okay, remember, it's control, competence, clarity. You give control while ensuring competence and clarity. Early on, I didn't really understand the whole thing. And so I gave a lot of control. There was inadequate competence and clarity. And so we made some mistakes. The guys were making mistakes. They were making operational mistakes, but the mistake I made was letting them make decisions that they weren't ready to make. So, and the whole thing almost collapsed. Fortunately, two things. One, my boss incubated us. We were just like a month into the experiment, and so my boss incubated us and he protected us, which was really, really, really critical. And number two was I would have a heart to heart with the team and said, this is a serious mistake. Are we on the right track? You guys think we're doing, you know, should we go back to the old way? And they said, no, we're doing right. We let you down. You know, they would beat themselves up kind of thing. And then we said, okay, well, let's, you know, pull up our britches and get back to work.
That failure also probably gave them the opportunity to know that they were safe to fail and to take accountability for that, which was also a very important lesson for them to realize very early on.
Yeah, that's important. But these failures that I'm talking about were bigger than failures that I wanted to tolerate. Okay. So I was okay with small failures, but the ones I just talked about were bigger than I would have wanted to have happen.
Right.
But when someone comes up to me and says, you know, I want to, I'm going to submerge the ship here, and I'm thinking, well, it really should be 2 miles over there and an hour later, that's really not a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, okay, fine, let's see how that works out. But if they want to submerge the ship and it was actually in shallow water or in a bad place, I would
that put people at risk.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd have to say, yeah, no, we're not going to do that. So I want to make that a point for the listeners, which is, in general, when you're dealing with adults, not telling them what to do is helpful for developing their leadership skills. But sometimes you do have to tell people what to do. Like if you got a kid says, oh, hey, Daddy, I'm not putting my seatbelt on today. You go, yeah, no, put on your seatbelt. So sometimes it's appropriate to tell people what to do.
Which aligns quite nicely with Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication, where he talks about, you know, it's a great opportunity to use great communication most of the time, but when there's threatening life situations, you really do have to go into that command and control behavior.
Well, so here's my thought on that, okay?
Cool.
So first off, if it's a life-threatening situation, if it's a life-threatening situation and they've got it wrong, you have to step in.
Yeah.
Then you back up and you say, why did my team get it wrong? Okay? And usually the problem is because we don't practice in these life-threatening situations. We don't sort of think of them ahead of time. We don't run through them. We don't run drills on them. So there's an absence of control and competence and clarity. So we, in the absence of competence and clarity, we have to take control. That's why leaders take control during these crises. I can tell you from the submarine, in combat operations, doing things like the most complex things we were doing, picking up SEAL teams, they worked even better when I gave up control. And the more complex the thing is, the more important it is to give up control, because you distribute the information and the decision making out through the team. The reason we have to fall back on command and control is because we don't have an adequately trained team, and it becomes an excuse. And so people think that I'm going back to command and control because it's life threatening, but the reason I'm going back to command and control is because I haven't trained my team.
Seems to me when you do, because you give them the control most of the time, when you do take that control or you impose yourself into the situation, do they listen more? Did you find that was the
situation?
Yeah,
that's a really interesting a point, and that's exactly what happened. So, of course, every once in a while, I would take control, and sometimes I did it for the wrong reason. Sometimes I did it because I was hungry or tired, and I was kind of falling back on bad habits. But if I really had to, you know, it wasn't like they said, oh, well, Captain, you're taking control. We don't really, you know, let's have a, you know, PowerPoint presentation and make sure we really appreciate this. Like, you know what? They would just do it. Because I know if he's stepping in, it must be really important and we must really need to pay attention. So, it took away all that.
So can I ask that just quickly on that, because I know there's other questions, but the vice versa of that is, did they hold you accountable when they felt you were jumping in too often? Did you find that?
What do you mean?
So in other words, if you were falling, you said you were falling back into the control bad
habits. They would say, Catherine, what are you doing? You're being a dick again, you know? And I kind of made it safe for them to say that. Because I say, look, guys, I want to do this. I know in myself that there's this tendency to fall back. And I need your help holding me accountable. Yeah. So like to nowadays, with companies, I encourage the CEO to give his people like yellow cards, and they can just hold the yellow cards to the CEO and say, "Hey, CEO, you told us." It's not like I'm being obnoxious in your face, but say, "Hey, you told us you wanted to be like this. We're helping you. We're shining a light back on you, saying you're not living up to the expectations of what you said you wanted to do."
Okay.
Yeah, and I like the idea of like it's like, you know, the football yellow card, red card, whatever it is.
One of the things we find, David, in a lot of corporates is sometimes what we refer to as the frozen middle, someone like yourself as the lieutenant of the ship is setting the scene, and even the layers below, and even the people below at the bottom understand it, but there's this middle that perhaps doesn't have the correct line to you, doesn't really understand or follow the process through. Is that something you found on your journey, particularly in the Navy, I guess, where you've got very defined roles as well?
Yeah, Craig, so that's really interesting. I do see that in companies a lot. And I'm not exactly sure why it is. I think maybe because that frozen middle, they come to identify their job security with the control that they can exert.
Yeah.
But sort of almost by accident on the submarine, actually that's the exact group I started with. I started with the chiefs, which were the senior enlisted guys on the submarine. So these are guys who have been in the Navy for 10 to 15 years. and would have been the most resistant, I think the most resistant group. And we did two things. One, we had a honest conversation about whether we wanted to do it. And number two is I just gave them authority by signing a piece of paper, which gave them authority and decision-making abilities that they didn't have. And they found that they liked it. And they found that their jobs mattered because we had like taken so much authority away from those guys. They were just like these rubber stamps, and they hated it. So, I don't know, maybe like by luck. I don't know. Because it wasn't really a thoughtful thing. It was just like, I got to start with this group, you know, kind of thing.
So, David, in Agile, we often use approaches like retrospectives to look at the way that we're working and understand the things that we want to change and the things that we don't want to change. And I picked up in your book that when you took over the ship, you went and spoke with all or most of the staff and asked them a bunch of questions about the way in which they were working.
Yeah.
What was that like, and what sort of insights did you gain out of that? What sort of questions did you ask them when you came on board?
I would ask them things like, first of all, for your listeners, I took over a ship where the captain before me quit. So it was an unexpected situation, and the ship was in poor shape in terms of morale, and so there was a lot of, you know, there was almost sort of this grieving thing that was going on, and all of a sudden they get this new guy unexpectedly airdropped on them to, quote, fix them, because everybody knew that they were, quote, messed up. And my impression was they weren't as messed up as they thought they were. And I wanted to let them express their fear. So I'd ask them things like, you know, what do you hope I change? But what do you hope I don't change? Because I knew that was kind of what was going on in their head, because I've kind of been on the other side. And then I would just try and listen. And I'm not saying I did everything that they said, but they felt at least like, oh, this guy at least listened to what I said. And that was, I think, really helpful for me. I only had a very short time to take over, and normally my training would have made me try to learn everything technical about the ship, to learn how this sonar system was different from the last one, to learn how this engine room and reactor plant were different from the last one, so I could have been a technical expert. But I had so little time, I realized the only thing I could really do was just talk to some people. And again, it was kind of this serendipitous, lucky thing that happened. Not really by design, and we kind of started out together feeling like we're on it together.
So effectively you were sort of like the coach, you were asking a lot of questions, not necessarily giving a lot of solutions or answers.
Yeah, and that's easy to do when you're not the problem, or right? Mm. I didn't create this culture that was there. Mm. Like, you're the new person coming in. So a year later, right, the question is, can you run around and do that same set of questions with your people? Because now the culture is largely defined by you. The organizational design is like your fingerprints are on it. And I'd have a mental activity when I left the ship and walked across the brow, I would imagine, and went home, I would sort of clear my mind. And then when I came back to work, I would imagine it's my first day on the job here. And I would try and sort of detach myself emotionally. And then I would come into work and my guys would get confused. I'd like, why are we doing it this way?
It's a fresh eyes.
Yeah. So this looks screwed up. Why are we doing it? And they say, well, what are you talking about? This is how you told us to do it 3 months ago. I said, yeah, but it looks screwed up. He said, well, yeah, we thought so too. But it's that flushing the brain and coming in with fresh eyes, yeah.
So, David, one of your favorite quotes that I had from your book is something that I picked up as I was flicking through it the other day, and it says, you know, I imagine a world where we all find satisfaction in our work. It's a world where every human being is being intellectually engaged, motivated, and self-inspired. You know, I can really see that for the future of an organization that I want to be in, or a culture that I'm part of. Mm. What's your advice to people on how to look at getting to that point, or especially with their own sphere of influence?
Look, anyone can be a leader. Everyone is a leader, because if you talk to someone in a day, that's an opportunity for leadership. And I think the reason, well, at least for me, leadership was hard because I had to go to the dark place. I had to embrace my fears, because my mind was programming me to say, take more control, and I had to give control. My mind was saying, make things more certain for me, and I had to make things less certain by letting you make a decision. My mind was saying, pretend like I know everything, fear of ignorance. And I would have to say, no, I don't know that, you know, I don't know. And so for me, the fortunate thing for me was at the other side of that was the fear of death, right? I literally saw that we were going to die, or we could die if we went down this bad path. So I was strongly, so these other fears were lesser fears for me. And I think one of the hard things for everybody and the listeners out there is you might not necessarily be motivated by fear of death, but if you go down this path, you will have to embrace your fears. And but by doing so, I think you'll really see that you're creating this environment where everyone else is feeling better. And that's the cost of leadership.
And I would imagine a lot of leaders, like manager leaders today, fear their jobs. Their sort of commercial environment that we're in, there is a lot of that fear which drives a lot of behavior.
Yeah, and I'm really bummed out by that. When I was the captain, my dream was to be the captain of a nuclear submarine. And so when I was the captain, like, I didn't give a shit, right? I didn't care about being promoted. So I just did what I thought was the right thing to do. And that helped me sort of deal with a lot of those fears, because there were real fears inside me to deal with my people. And then there were sort of these bureaucratic fears of, oh, am I going to get promoted and all that stuff. And I didn't care about any of those. I call it care, not care. Like, care deeply and passionately about the people and the mission, but no care about the bureaucratic consequences to myself. I don't know if that's good for everybody. I'm kind of hesitant to say that, because some people do need their job. But if you're in a job that's stressful, it's taking a toll on your health. And you got to really think twice. Am I trading my life for this paycheck? Because you are.
Segueing a little, one of my favorite quotes, I couldn't actually find the quote, but maybe you could tell it to me better, was around the rudder movements. So there was one in there around I think it was like a small rudder movement.
A little rudder far from the rocks is better than a lot of rudder close.
So, I mean, it's an intriguing statement about foresight, I guess, and planning ahead. But interestingly, in the world that we live in, which is quite complex, there's this philosophy around there about keeping your options open and having a last responsible moment commitment. How do you see those two sort of working together, or do you think they're at odds?
I think they're together. The thing I'm picturing when I say that is the team goes off to work on a project, and they're making decisions about how it's going to look, what the user experience is going to be, what these stories are, and there are all these decisions that they're grappling with, and there may be some big decisions. And what I see happen too often is the team is well downrange, and then we finally get to talk to the CEO, and the whole thing blows up, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not what we're trying to do. Da, 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 da. And so, because we had to schedule a meeting, and they got to, you know, we got to work through the secretary, and finally we get half an hour in the schedule. And so, you know, we're not doing any of that. I want the product owner and the project leads to just walk in my office and say, with a piece of paper, here's what the UX is going to look like. What do you think? Like, just get real early feedback to the CEO in a 10-second meeting. Because the CEO, okay, good, no, yes, whatever. And then, boom, you're off to the next thing. Those frequent, that's what I don't see, because we have this sort of architecture of arthritis around scheduling these meetings with the CEO's time. And you got to, because we protect the CEO's time, but the team's time is very important too.
And the cost of it, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess it's also that idea about in many of the organizations where we work, teams tend to do lots of work and try and strive for that piece of perfection and then seek sign-off.
That's exactly what it is, yeah. The team wants to show something that's perfect rather than something that they can get a reaction. You just need to work long enough so you can get a reaction to it, right?
Mm-hmm. So we're seeking more of that permission to proceed.
Right.
Using those fast feedback loops to an endorsement to continue.
Right. And some of these guys say, well, look, it's all on the wall, right? The CEO could walk down here and look on. That's not good enough, right? You got to go to her, right? Because they're just walking around and seeing stuff, right? That's not good enough. Say, oh, well, look, our UX is on the wall. Yeah, well, so were a bunch of other things.
So that's interesting in these large, really large organisations.
Mm.
The stratification of the layers is so big.
Mm. Dense.
Dense, that's a good word. How do you suggest that you do that? Ideas, well, thoughts?
So if you said, okay, let me map the CEO or the senior leadership's time. Like, let me just observe them and take data on what they're spending their time on. And there are studies on this, but they spend a lot of time in these meetings. And what's valuable? All these meetings we're going to, or the ability to have the like short interactions, conversations. One of the problems is that, you know, we have this idea that every meeting has to be 30 minutes. Like, why? How about schedule something for 30 seconds? Right? Or like 7 minutes, you know? So, like, we're like, you know, we're hostage to the way Excel schedules meetings, and it's crazy. So I got rid of I canceled every meeting that I was going to. I said, I'm not going to meetings. You guys can go. You guys can talk to each other, but I'm not coming because there was no value in me going to a lot of these things. And then once meetings got good and we actually had real conversations, I wanted my feedback, then I would start going again. But we also got really good at doing meetings. We had a lot more information conveyed in a much shorter periods of time just by changing. Here's one example on how to run a meeting. Or here's how not to run a meeting. Hey, we got to make a decision on what percent R&D we're going to, what percent of company revenue we're going to spend on R&D next year. So let's have a talk. We'll talk about it. Da, 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 da. Okay, now what does everyone think? Wrong, because everyone's polluted by the conversation. But you have to say, start with, okay, what does everyone think about this? Then have a conversation, especially with the people with the outliers. Like, let them write it down and think. So there's a lot to how we run meetings. And again, this is an example of we're going to build consensus. We're going to reduce variability. That's why we run the meeting that way, as opposed to if I want to embrace variability, I want to get the people's, oh, man, I should have said this in the keynote. Because it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. You know, I said, hey, we have these habits and rituals that are about reducing variability. We don't even know it. Like, this is one of them.
Yeah, it seems to me that it's fallback, isn't it? It's fallback command and control straight away.
Yeah, we don't even know that it is. Yeah, well, this is just how we do it.
But is it any wonder? I mean, we're trained as from children all the way up through the way in which we're educated via command and control.
Right.
It's just reinforced our whole lives.
Yeah, and then you don't even know it's command and control. It's just like that's how it is. Exactly. And that's what I'm trying to get people to do is think, why do I say, are you sure, right? Rather than how sure are you?
And that's what happens to us a lot as agilists. We come along with these crazy ideas of servant leadership, which is pretty much what you've been describing the whole time we've been talking, right? Safe to fail, trust the team. I mean, God forbid that you trust the team. You know, the guys on the ground who actually know what's going on and know how to do the work and trust them to figure out the solutions. So we have the same problems because when we start interacting with the leadership, it's a massive challenge to their whole world.
Right. Yeah.
So are we winning this game as society and organizations?
We're winning.
At what pace?
Well, you know, it feels slow, but it's really fast, right? Like humans have been on the planet for 50,000 years or something, and command and control has been here for a long time. The Industrial Revolution was 300 years. And really in the last sort of 50 years, the idea that value is, you know, knowledge worker was at first used by Peter Drucker in the 1950s or something. So it was about as old as me. And that seems slow to you, but from a human scale, this is pretty fast. And what's happening is just getting faster. Like, look at how these companies are creating value these days. You know, 13 guys at Instagram, you know, are bought by for $1 billion. 17 guys at WhatsApp are bought for $17 billion. Right? It's crazy.
So what's next in the journey for yourself, David? What are you up to going forward?
You know, this is what I'm doing. I don't know what's next. Well, I'm working on a couple books. One book is collecting stories of companies because too many people say, oh, well, that's just a submarine thing. It's not really a real life thing. So I'm collecting stories of companies and sports teams that are successfully doing this. And we're also are making a coloring book on how to talk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's all these little things. So here's an example. Is it better to say, you talk to yourself, Renee, right?
In my head all the time?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yes. Okay, so you're talking...
Definitely
not out loud. No, that's okay.
That must be confusing. Sometimes we ask it not to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So the question is, okay, when you talk to yourself, do you say, I can do it or Renee can do it?
Definitely I can do it.
Yeah, so a lot of people do, and it turns out actually saying Renee can do it is a better motivator, because saying Renee can do it puts you in third person and it distances you a little bit emotionally. It takes you sort of emotionally out of what it is you're sort of afraid.
It's like my resume is in third person.
Right. So it's just it's this idea that the words we use really matter. They really can help us. And so
what's that to do with the coloring book?
Oh, well, that's just how we're going to deliver it, because I want to do, like, what's the most unexpected thing some stiff, you know, middle-aged white nuclear submarine captain can do? Make a coloring book. So that's what I'm going to do.
David, you mentioned that you're collecting stories of companies who are seeing success.
Yeah.
Can you share the names of some of those companies, or do you have a quick story about something?
Or do you want anyone to send you stories?
Yeah, send me stories to david@turntheshiparound.com. Any story that involves... you don't need to use my quote material. Just any story that involves giving people control, okay, is what we're... So I'll tell you one. Sports team, University of Kentucky baseball team. The batting coach. He's telling the kids, he's coaching them, telling them what to do. Bottom of the league. He reads the book. He says, you know what? I'm going to try this. So the kids now are going on deck. In the practice, he's still coaching them, but when they go on deck in the game, he's like, well, what do you intend to do? How are you going to deal with this pitcher? And the kid's like, maybe I'll do this. So the kids, and then the very next year, top of the league. And they signed a kid for a lot of money at the majors, and he got promoted and was hired to be the head coach at another school. So, you know, win all around. But it all started with him stopping. It started with him not doing something that he had done, which was telling these kids what to do.
Well, myself, I got nothing less out of today. was that just the change in the verb? Exactly, you said the words "I intend to." Mm. That list that you gave us was really powerful.
Mm.
I really enjoyed that, and I actually will take that away and just start having a go at that myself. So, thank you for that, and I mean that quite sincerely.
Yeah, awesome. Really enjoyed it. So, I hope you enjoyed your trip to Australia.
Well, it's not over yet, but yeah, it's been great. I'm going to go bike riding in Melbourne.
And if people want to contact you?
Yeah, go to our website, davidmarquet.com. The best thing to do is I encourage people to sign up for our weekly nudges, which are a lot of these things we're talking about. And so if you go to that homepage, davidmarquet.com, there's a little sign-up thing. And it's just usually me on a video. We try and keep it less than 60 seconds. And it's just these little tidbits. And you train your brain. You take physical actions to train your brain. And then if you just hit reply, it comes back to me. It's not like some news, it doesn't go to some dead inbox. It actually just comes right back to me.
So that constant reinforcement of a learning culture.
Yeah. You need practice, right? You need help because we're going to rewire a lot of old habits here.
Awesome.
Excellent. Anything else from you?
So I just want to thank David for his time today at Agile Australia, but also more broadly for, this what you bring to the Agile community. We really appreciate having you part of it.
Thank you. It's been great. I think you guys are sort of basically I'm trying to leverage you guys. I'm trying to use you, okay? Let's just be honest. Because I think you guys and the things that you're doing, which is fundamentally about giving teams control, is kind of exactly what I'm doing. So it's a great synergy.
It is a synergy or symbiotic relationship, because the reality is what you're doing and saying is validating what we've been doing and saying for so long, but it's practical examples in another arena that people can actually grasp.
Right.
So I think it's really good.
Right.
And to listeners, if you have any questions for us, you can contact us at Renee@TheAgileRevolution.
Or Tony@TheAgileRevolution. And we'll speak for Craig, who had to rush off. Craig@TheAgileRevolution.
And Tyson@elementdigital.com.au.
Great. Well, there's only one thing left for us to say, and usually at this point we say viva la revolution.
Yeah.
Join us in.
Viva la revolution.
Oh, let's try that again. All right, ready? One, two, three.
Viva la revolution.